with the slow-mo. Heard me in the 80s, JV's on the promo. Am I never in the quest to get the paper on the caper? But now, let me take it to the queen side.
It is the birthday of Ali Shaheed Muhammad, Tribe Called Quest. So we celebrate with their music in our break here as we go into our next conversation here on the Mark Steiner Show. We're about to look at what's going on in Iraq with the President of the United States, Barack Obama, announcing and, of course, implementing the bombing against ISIS. And, you know, as we talk to folks about this in Iraq and the people, Iraqis, over the last several days that I've been talking to, one of the guests who's on the show a great deal, Dr. Tabat Abdullah, could not join us today, who was a member of a lot of left-wing democratic radical groups in Iraq that stood up to Saddam, and he had to flee. He is a Yazidi, and we had this conversation about that. The Yazidis being one of the most ancient people on this planet in terms of the continuity of their religion based on the Zoroastrianism and the empires before that and who they are, and that Iraq itself being the home of many ancient cultures and religions. The most ancient forms of Christianity, the most ancient forms of religions that marry Islam and Christianity, like the Shabak in Iraq and more. And they all say the same thing to me, and we'll wrestle with some of this. In all the notes I've gotten, it's pretty similar, that Saddam Hussein was a vicious fascist dictator. And he said, but what they are experiencing now in Iraq and their families are experiencing in Iraq almost makes Saddam's era feel like a paradise. And our country has a great deal to do with that, with a war that we started without necessity, a war we were lied to about that have caused the destruction of this country and that entire region, and now we have to pay the consequences. What are those consequences? The U.S. has to pay or not, and what should be the response? We are here, joined by Phyllis Bennis once again, director of the New International Islam Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of numerous books, including Ending the War, U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer, and her latest book on Israel-Palestine, which I just bought for my daughter, and is fantastic. Michael Rubin, who's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, former Pentagon official. He instructs senior military officers deployed to the Middle East and Afghanistan on regional politics and teaches classes on board deploying U.S. aircraft carriers. And he has lived in post-revolution Iran, Yemen, and both pre- and post-war Iraq, and spent time with Taliban before 9/11. Author of the book Dancing with the Devil, The Perils of Engaging Rogue Regimes, and Ross Caputi, who is a veteran of the occupation of Iraq, on the board of ISLAVI, an organization designed for those who feel that they were complicit in the war, occupation, and displacement, and want to take responsibility to the harm they committed in their name. He's director of the documentary film Fear Not the Path of Truth, A Veteran's Journey After Fallujah. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Great to be with you.
Thank you.
And you all can join us here, 410-319-8888. Write to me here, talk@steinershow.org. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Let me start with you, Phyllis Bennis. I'm curious as to your reaction when President Barack Obama announced that he was going to use the U.S. Air Force and Navy and drones to bomb ISIS in defense of the Yazidis on the mountain and also to protect American interests. What was your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction was there is humanitarian support needed. This is a really dumb way to do it, to use President Obama's own description of the Iraq war, that this looked like he's relaunching his own dumb war. This is a real slippery slope. The United Nations, which actually does know how to do airdrop without involving military goals on the side, the way the U.S. has so disastrously done them in the past, had offered to provide that kind of technical engagement with the Iraqi Air Force, which is small, has small planes, which are better actually able to drop what was needed, if they had the right training, the right equipment, the right people. The U.N. offered it. The government in Baghdad said no, and instead of the U.S. saying, look, we pay you. We pay for your parliament, we pay for your prime ministership, we pay for your guns, we pay for your uniforms. You've got to accept aid from the United Nations now. Instead, the Obama administration simply said, oh, okay, you don't want the UN, fine, we will act as Maliki's air force and the Kurds' air force. And by linking those political / military goals with the humanitarian goals, it puts at great risk the possibility that this is going to be a real slippery slope to a much greater engagement.
And Ross, and before I go to Ross Caputi, Michael Rubin, your analysis of President Barack Obama's speech, and then we'll go to Ross Caputi.
Well, I mean, I think it's positive to react very quickly to a looming humanitarian tragedy. And there's no way to train another Air Force in the interim. And I would disagree with Phyllis with regard to the UN's logistical capabilities there. That said, what we're really seeing is action without a strategy. So I would agree with Phyllis that that's a very dangerous situation to get in. And there's also a bit of cognitive dissonance. Why defend Erbil but not Baghdad? Why confront ISIS in Iraq but not in Syria? It's that sort of question that I think that President Obama needs to answer, lest, and again, I'm agreeing with Phyllis here, we go down a slippery slope.
Ross?
Well, I think the U.S. government has done so much to escalate the situation in Iraq to the point we are today. I don't know if there is options that we could take right now that could avert further bloodshed. Certainly months ago, there were options that could have been done or not done. Certainly even years ago. But today, I think the things have spiraled into such a mess. I don't know that there are options that the U.S. can take that will just avoid the violence. And I think the only thing we can do at this point is just to send reparations for the harm that we brought to this country.
Well, let me pick up on this for a moment. I mean, I think that what you just mentioned, reparations for what we've done to this country, I know you're involved with a number of veterans, Ross, that are working like a number of Vietnam veterans did to kind of go back and try to undo some of what was done and to make a bridge between people. But we're also now in Iraq in an active war still that's taking place. And what I said earlier, Phyllis, I just want to wrestle with this one bit for a moment, because here we have American planes bombing right now.
Right.
There are reasons why the United States did not give Iraq an air force. Part of that had to do with Israel not wanting Iraq to have an air force, in things that I've been reading. And that, so the reality is that we destroyed the infrastructure of an entire nation and set this kind of place ablaze between ethnic groups. The tensions may have been there before the war started, but we let them, but they erupted because of this war. So, but what is our responsibility then, to allow ISIS now to come in and march through and take over parts of the Kurds?
No. I mean, what we're looking at here, and you're absolutely right, Mark, that this is something that is rooted in the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. The creation of sectarian parties that the coalition forces imposed on Iraq when they disbanded the existing political parties through what was called debathification, disbanded the military. What we're looking at now is not simply ISIS. We have to be very clear that this is not some incredibly magically powerful group of Islamists that suddenly are able, out of nowhere, to be, you know, jump up in Syria and suddenly be able to take over huge swaths of territory by themselves. They are winning amounts of territory in Iraq because they have support. Now, they have support from three different groupings that we need to understand, which tells us a little bit about what it's going to take to defeat them politically. One is they're getting support militarily from former Iraqi military people that were Ba'athists, that were nationalists and secularists of all sorts, who were thrown out of the military, lost their jobs when the U.S. occupation took hold in their country, and they've been waiting for an opportunity to challenge, particularly those who are Sunni, to challenge the Shia sectarianism of the U.S.-backed government in Baghdad. That's the first group. The second group that's supporting them are a lot of ordinary Iraqi Sunnis in a number of places who have welcomed them, not because they agree with their extremist versions of Islam and their dire punishments and their misogyny, but who have welcomed them because they see them as less of a threat than the Shia sectarianism of the U.S.-backed Maliki government. And the third is the Sunni tribal leaders, who have engaged in support of ISIS in many areas, again, not because they necessarily agree with them, but because they see it as a way of challenging, in ways that haven't been available in any other way, the Maliki government. So the creation of a different government, getting rid of Maliki, we'll see whether it lasts with the new prime minister that's been selected, who is not Maliki, We'll see whether that has any significant change or whether there's actually going to be an internal palace coup of some sort on either side. We don't know yet. That's just happened in the last couple of hours. But what we're seeing is a scenario where the government is seen as so bad, so sectarian, so repressive, so responsible for arrests and torture and killing of its opponents and its perceived sectarian opponents, mainly Shia, mainly Sunni, by this Shia sectarian organization calling itself a government, that they are getting support to the extremists of organizations like ISIS. So you can't just look at this as, oh my God, these are extremists, we have to kill them. They don't exist in a vacuum.
So, let me go back to Michael, then go over to Ross. I mean, Michael, I guess would you agree that they don't exist in a vacuum, that this is a much more complex thing than just ISIS? And how then, from your perspective, does the American government respond?
Okay, well, I mean, I would agree with Phyllis with regard to some of the factions she identified, although I disagree with her general narrative. Without doubt, I've talked since this uprising began. I've traveled to the region and met with senior generals who served under Saddam Hussein. I've met with representatives of the tribes. And they did say that they were sort of seeking to channel ISIS. And then they weren't shy about saying that they wished to stab ISIS in the back. Unfortunately, they were too clever by half, and ISIS wasn't that stupid. And so we have a situation where what basically happened is some of the disaffected Sunni Arabs inside Iraq literally played with fire, and now they've gotten burned. We could see this with regard, for example, to the destruction of the tomb of Nabi Yunus, as well as for the targeting of some of the Christian churches and the Yazidi community inside Iraq. At the same time, it's important to recognize that sectarianism didn't start in 2003. Saddam Hussein and indeed the entire Ba'athist regime was extremely sectarian, and we can be quite open to say that many, as many in the North right now, see the grass is always greener on the other side. Many of the Shiites would no longer ever want to live under the Ba'athists because they were suffering under Saddam Hussein the way the Yazidis and the Christians are perhaps suffering under ISIS itself. Likewise, it's important to realize that the idea that ISIS and its actions are rooted in ideology, not simply in grievance, no matter how magnanimous Prime Minister Maliki may have been towards the Sunnis. It wouldn't have changed ISIS's fundamental ideology, nor should we look at this as simply an indigenous movement inside Iraq. Of course, this movement also exists in Syria, where the United States hasn't been directly involved. And many of those who are doing the fighting on behalf of ISIS aren't even Iraqi or Syrians. The Turks have kept an open border, basically allowing anyone who wants to flood into the region to do so. Ultimately, this is a much larger problem. That's why it's not simply a matter of playing whack-a-mole. At this point, we've got to do something more than wag our finger at them all.
And it's interesting. I was thinking about where you fought as a Marine, Ross Caputi, and you talked about the complexity of what happened in Fallujah when you were there and that it wasn't as simple as we were making it. And you were talking also about what Phyllis was talking about in terms of the complexity of the makeup of people who were fighting in Fallujah, and the man who is now the head of ISIS was actually one of those in Fallujah who was arrested by the Americans and Iraqi forces, let go, and is now the head of ISIS, as you see. But so talk a bit about how you view this complexity from both as a soldier on the ground and what you think then how we should respond.
So I agree with Dr. Benes that it's the brutal sectarian policies of the Maliki government and the U.S. support for those policies that created this base of support that allows ISIS to exist in Iraq right now. But I think things have begun to shift in the last 2 months where ISIS has really started to alienate themselves from their base of support through the way that they administer the communities that they control, you know, by doing these Sharia courts and, you know, their general sectarianism, and also because they've become more antagonistic towards the other militia groups that they were once cooperative with, and now they're sort of demanding that these groups make an oath of allegiance to Abu Bakr. So all these different militia groups are ready to turn on ISIS, but they're preoccupied with defending cities like Fallujah and defending other communities from the attacks of the Maliki government. So I think if the U.S. would stop aiding the Maliki government and Iran would also stop playing this role that they've been playing in Iraq, these militias, and I'm thinking of the Association of Muslim Scholars in Iraq, the General Military Council of Iraqi Revolutionaries, Naqshbandi, these groups would very happily turn on the Islamic State and eject them from Iraq, just as they did to Al-Qaeda in 2008 during that period, during the surge. And I think it's only because they're fighting on two fronts right now, against Maliki and also with this antagonistic relationship that they now have with the Islamic State, that they haven't ejected the Islamic State from Iraq yet.
So, Phyllis, I'm turning to you now because I know you have to run in just a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
Just to kind of pick up on what both of the guests were saying, what Ross was saying, because I really want to try to get to the heart of the, in this mass confusion and this the tumult that exists, how do we respond? I mean,
well, I think the way the U.S. should respond is to stand back, support. I mean, I was not proposing. Maybe I misspoke, or maybe somebody misunderstood me. But I was not proposing that the U.S. should be training, or the U.N. or anybody else should be training up a new Iraqi air force, but rather that whatever humanitarian assistance is needed should come from the United Nations, not from the United States, where it is inevitably linked to military strategic goals and not kept at the humanitarian level. But what we should be doing is recognizing, as Ross was just saying, that once there is a change in the government in Baghdad, there will be a huge drop-off in support for ISIS or for IS, for the Islamic State. When that happens, Iraqis themselves are going to sort out their rejection of this kind of extremism. What happens when the U.S. goes in acting as, despite the language of the administration, what they're really doing is sending the U.S. Air Force to act as Maliki's Air Force and the Kurds' Air Force. And what that does is further the kind of sectarian divide. Does this mean that the U.S. is now going to support Kurdish independence? They haven't said that, but it certainly gives the Kurdish leadership a great deal more international credential, if you will, with having the U.S. support. The same with Maliki. No matter what words Secretary Kerry or the President or members of Congress may say about the need for a more inclusive government in Baghdad, as long as they are actually sending planes, sending bombers, sending bombs in the interest of one side, it's going to be perceived as sending support to the government in Baghdad. That doesn't help the effort to get rid of Maliki by Iraqis themselves, not by the U.S., and the effort to challenge IS by Iraqis themselves, rather than having the U.S. go in once again using military force and leaving behind what? A model like what we left behind in Libya? Is that the model that we're looking at?
Phyllis Menace, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us. Sorry you have to run, but we'll be talking soon.
It's been a pleasure. Sorry I have to go.
That's all right. So, Michael Rubin, let's jump right back into this. I mean, what Phyllis was saying, we now saw the news that Haider al-Abadi was being named, the seems to be taking over from Maliki, perhaps. We'll see. A man who used to own a dumpling shop in London, but actually was a real fighter inside that regime, it seemed, to allow Iraqis to have more control over the revitalization of the country, and was also in pursuit of the Blackwater, Suyan Blackwater. It's an interesting character. So what does all this mean for the future, do you think?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. Haider al-Abadi, who I know, is the nominee. He hasn't yet been named prime minister, so we still need to check that out.
Right.
Second of all, a fresh start will be helpful, of course. Many Iraqis have been asking for that. But the problems aren't personified in Prime Minister Maliki. The problems are otherwise. If you ask any Iraqi community, however you want to define that Iraqi community, Iraq is one of these unique countries where its population is 258% of reality, because every community tends to exaggerate its numbers. One of the problems we have with the Sunni tribes, for example, in Nineveh, as in Mosul earlier this year, as in Tikrit and Beji as well, is that a complete rejection of the idea that the Shiites should have an equal say in the government moving forward. One thing I do need to caution, however, is we shouldn't be Pollyannish about the United Nations, because Iraq has a very unique perception of the United Nations, different from many of the countries around it, simply because of the Oil for Food program, which was massively corrupt, especially in the minorities, the Kurds, the Yazidis, and so forth, were denied rations, were treated as hostages simply because the United Nations refused to distribute food to them directly, allowing Saddam Hussein to distribute it instead. I mean, the tragedy of the Yazidis is that they really have been targeted by all sides.
Ross Caputi, I'm you know, again, we do, I think, have a really honest debate to have in this country about what our response should be to what has happened in Iraq. I know your organization has talked a lot about the importance of taking responsibility and helping to rebuild Iraq, but we're still in the midst of this conflagration, of this war that are taking place. So again, I go back to where my original points to you, both as a vet and somebody who writes and thinks about this and analyzes this, what our response should be, and is there anything wrong in your perspective with the steps that President Barack Obama has taken already?
Well, it's difficult when you let things to descend to the point that they did, where suddenly you have this, you know, group of ethnic minorities trapped on a mountain, surrounded by this sectarian militia group who's, you know, just waiting to kill them. You know, at that point, when you let things descend to that level, I think, I don't know, you're kind of trapped into condoning airstrikes at this point. But I think the way that this has been framed is in a very ahistorical way, where it kind of ignores all the actions taken by the U.S. government that let things descend to this point where we are in this really terrible situation, and it doesn't seem that there are nonviolent solutions to it. But apart from that, I agree totally with what Dr. Bennis was saying, that we need to withdraw support from the government in Iraq. We need to let Iraqis sort out their own security problems, and they're perfectly capable of sorting out their own security problems. If there weren't, you know, other international players interfering in their affairs, notably the U.S. and Iran, that are sending in troops and now airstrikes to support the Maliki government against what they call terrorism, but it's much more complicated than that. The Islamic State is a terrible group, but there are other militias fighting on the ground, rising up against the Maliki government, which are not terrorist organizations, which have legitimate grievances with the Maliki government. And, you know, we need to listen to their voices and respect their wishes, I think.
So I'm curious, just very quickly before we run out of time, I meant to ask this when you said a moment ago, Michael Rubin, that you knew Al-Hadra personally. Will Al-Abadi personally, would he be any different in terms of sectarian politics than al-Maliki? Does he really represent something different from your perspective?
No, I don't think so. Ultimately, he is going, the nature of the beast, the nature of the way Iraqi politics work, is that we've descended into the situation where most of the parties are either sectarian-based or ethnic-based. One of the proposals which is out there, which has been put forward out there by several of the Sunni tribes, is that perhaps it's time to have an amendment to the Constitution, if you will, inside Iraq, which would suggest that no parties can be organized around ethnicity or religion, that they should only be organized, for example, around economic philosophy in order to encourage pan-sectarianism or religious diversity, if you will, and ethnic diversity. But that's still a long shot. The other proposal that's being put out there by the tribes and by many of the Sunni parties is that there should be much greater administrative federalism, so Baghdad plays much less of a role in everyone's life, and basically Iraq's oil revenues, most of which come from southern Iraq, get distributed either to the provincial leadership or even to the district leadership, with the central government only conducting foreign affairs and basic defense.
Michael Rubin is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is Dancing with the Devil, The Perils of Engaging Rogue Regimes. And Ross Caputi, whose latest book is Fear Not the Path of Truth, A Veteran's Journey After Fallujah, who's a veteran of the war in Iraq and board of directors of ISLA, trying to seek reparations and relations between Iraq and repairing the harm we've done. So Michael Rubin and Ross Caputi, earlier Phyllis Bennis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
It's been a pleasure. And we'll, of course, continue to look to see what happens in the world in the Middle East and how it affects them and us with people who understand the situation better than most. Reminding you on our way out of here that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. You can go to www.mecu.com for more information. You can also log on to signershow.org and click on their banner, MECU, Baltimore's Credit Union, that is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MECU invests in you. MECU, Baltimore's Credit Union. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineers, Andre Melton. Our interns, Siana Greaves and Sam Saper and Maggie Dyer. Our interns, to hear the show again, podcast any of our past shows, find out information about our guests, the work they do, and linking to their work, please go to our website at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For public radio, it'll be EAA 88.9 FM, celebrating the 88 days of summer. I'm Mark Steiner. That's Tribe Called Quest. Take care. Do I see that? Cause I gotta speak the truth, man. Doing what we feel for, but music is the proof. And planet on the ground, the act is so together. Bonafide strong, you need leverage to sever. The unit, yes, the unit, yes, the unit. Call the jazz is delivering each year. LP.